Welcome to this week's episode of Double A Minutes. I'm Jeff Mabry with Eric Dahl.
Hey, hey, hey.
Eric, it's just after the close here, February 2nd. It's Groundhog Day. Apparently, Punxsutawney Phil did not see a shadow, so we're due for an early spring. I guess his track record over the past 10 or so years has been 40%, so I would say he's due for it to be correct, to get that coin flip.
Maybe the listeners can flip their own coin and compare the results.
I'm just hoping. I always want the early spring. You know, it's supposed to be rain a lot this weekend here in Southern California, so I'll be happy for an early spring. With that, let's get into the where are we for. Let's cover January 1st, and then I'll kind of talk about the week. So here, let's look at here in January. We had S&P up about 1.7%. That was led by communication services up 4.5%, and the financials were up 3%, and same with healthcare. So financials, healthcare, and communication services, the winners. The losers, looks like it was real estate down 4.75%, consumer discretionary down almost 4.5%, and materials down almost 4%. So a pretty mixed bag there. I guess that's what you expect from a up 1.7 type month. Russell 1000 was up 1.4%. Russell 2000 down almost 4%. So big divergence there. Growth was up 2.5% and value was flat. Looks like up 10 basis points. To round it out, the S&P 500 equal weight was down 82 basis points on the month. Similarly, if we go roll over to the bond market, the 10-year was up 3 bips to 391. Long bond was up 14, so the biggest movement in absolute value terms there on the long bond closed at 417. And it looks like the 2-year was down 4 basis points to close at 421. What did that mean for fixed income returns? Ag was down 0.25%. Governments were down 0.25%. Agency mortgages down about 0.5% there. And investment grade corporate bonds down 20 basis points or so. Your non-index sectors, high yield was flat. Bank loans were up slightly, up about 0.25%. And EM, after a very strong fourth quarter, was down 1.25%. Commodities. We had a mixed bag, as you would expect. Again, Bloomberg Commodity Index was up almost 0.5%. Ags were down 1%. Energy up the most, up 2.8%. Industrial metals down 1.9%, and precious metals down 1.3%. Oh, I guess livestock was the big winner, up almost 9% there on livestock. We had WTI crude up 6%, and did the month at, or and actually it's today at 72. Copper was up slightly at not even up 1%, and gold was down 70 basis points. If we roll over to what happened this past week, obviously 2 days into this month, this past week, S&P was up 1.7%. It looks like the big winner was consumer discretionary up 3.5%. A lot of that was today. Communication services up 3%. So those were your two big winners. Only two sectors were negative on the week. Energy down 40 basis points. And real estate down 1 basis point. So we'll call that still a loss because it did end up negative, but you know, very slightly. We could call that flat if we wanted to. Russell 1000 was up 1.5%. Russell 2000 down 0.5%. Growth continued to outperform value, with growth up 2.2% and value only up 0.75%. But looking at the S&P equal weight, was up just over 1% there. So kind of hanging in there on the equal weighted side. Obviously, we're going to talk about the Fed here and talk about what happened on a big, heavy macro week. But we did end the week at the 10-year down 12 basis points. So a pretty big move there to close at 402 today. The long bond was down 15 basis points to 422. But the 2-year kind of almost surprisingly, but once we talked about the Fed, maybe not so surprising, up 2 basis points to end at 437. So kind of a mixed bag there. The 2s, 10s curve kind of re-inverted a little bit by 13 basis points and is at negative 34 basis points today. What did that mean for the fixed income index returns? The ag was up just over 0.5%, with the treasuries leading the way up 0.75%. Agency mortgages just slightly below at 0.69%, and investment grade corporate bonds up just over 0.5% there. The kind of non-index sectors, your best performing sector was EM, up 0.5%. Both high yield, so your below investment grade corporate credit, both were down on the week. High yield down about 16 basis points, and bank loans down about 0.1%. So a pretty good returns there from the fixed income market overall. All right. So you got you had green in fixed income, green in stocks, and of course, then you'd have negative in commodities. Commodity Bloomberg commodity market down 2% on the week. Looks like energy was the big loser there, down 5.78%, with crude oil being the big loser, down over 7% on the week to close, as I mentioned earlier, at 72 and change for a barrel of crude oil. The industrial metals were down 2%. The big winner, again, livestock was up 1%, and precious metals were up 70 basis points, with gold leading the way there, up 1% to close the week at 2038. That's it from the market perspective, Eric. I don't know if you noticed anything, or we just want to get into the macro and kind of talk about how the macro and the Fed affected markets.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I'd say is as we're kind of flirting with these all-time highs on the stock market, I mean, just the bull is loose out there and the bears are running for cover. And I think that that's a segue into our macro for the week. And we started the week with the housing market. And so for all those homeowners and those interested in the housing market, it continues to be very resilient. The print was positive for November on the 20 city index. And the month over month change was 0.15%, which seems like a small amount, but the estimate was a little better than that. Still positive growth in the housing market. That leaves the year over year number at for November 5.4%. So homeowners still seeing their equity appreciate in value last year. When you kind of go down to we also got the Consumer Confidence Board confidence numbers for January on Tuesday, and those came in at 114.8. Kind of better than the prior, but not like incredible, but definitely a better scenario than we had seen previously. Were you going to say something, Jeff?
Nope, I was not.
Oh, sorry, got a little crackled there. It's all good. Moving forward, looking at the kind of conference board expectations, they came in a little better than the previous number as well. And the present situation, that was 83.8, and the present situation came in at 161.3. I'm pretty skeptical of soft data like this because I feel like humans' opinions change and they're pretty volatile, but it gives you an assessment, something to try and tease out where the psyche of the market is, but I'm not or the consumer, let's say, I'm not a believer that it's really a strong indicator of anything.
If you remember, Eric, well, we did talk about that last week in our discussion of hard versus soft data. So if you missed that episode, that's episode 150.
Yeah, that's a good point. We did discuss that and went into kind of some of those intricacies there regarding hard versus soft data. Now, we also got JOLTS on Tuesday, and JOLTS has been much maligned as of late because the response rate is so low. So it's kind of tough to really believe that one as well. Nonetheless, we still look at it, and it came in pretty big increase to 9,026,000. So a lot of job openings out there if you believe the JOLTS report. And if you look at the quits rate, which I actually like to look at more, because it really tells you something about the psyche of the respondents, at least. The quits rate remained at 2.2%, and it's kind of back into the pre-pandemic levels, if you want to think of it that way. In the like hot job market of 21, it got all the way up to like 3% quit rate, which is very high, and it's indicative that people are just willing to, because when you quit your job, you're never going to do that unless you think you can get a better job or you're going to retire. But this is really about people quitting their job who think they're going to get a better job. So I think that that's a strong indicator of psyche in the labor market. And it's back to like levels we saw in 2018, 2019. So labor market's still going along, but it's not at that elevated level that it used to be. On Wednesday, We got the ADP employment change, and nobody really paid attention. It came at 107K, which was less than the estimate, less than the previous, but it really wasn't that important because on Wednesday, we also had the Fed decision, which we're going to talk about as our topic of the week, but the Federal Reserve left rates unchanged, and they signaled that they're not likely to cut as much as the market thinks, at least in the near term. And we'll dissect all of that in our topic of the week. But that was very important and had huge implications. And you saw a lot of repricing in risk markets after that press conference by the chairman, Jay Powell. We also got the employment cost index, which came in at positive 0.9%. And once again, you know, that drives inflation. I mean, employment costs going up causes services costs to go up, as the cost of services is very, very correlated to the cost of the labor that goes into those services. Going into a huge week this week, so sorry if I'm running long, but we had just a deluge of data come down, and we want to keep all of our listeners informed. Thursday, we got initial jobless claims, came in 224,000, 12K over the estimate, but pretty in line with the prior of 215K. Continuing claims continues to tick up, pun intended. It came in at 1,898,000, which was an increase of 59,000 versus the estimate. And so if you're looking at the moving average of that, it's kind of been trending upwards over time. So that's something to keep an eye on. Maybe some people are, you know, staying on the sidelines a little bit longer. If you find yourself out of work or you quit your job, it's probably taking longer to find gainful employment. On Thursday, we also got the ISM manufacturing data for January. It came in at 49.1, which was better than the previous print of 47.1. So a little bit of, let's just say, I wouldn't call it a bright spot, but a less dark spot for manufacturing there. And we got some like corroborating data in the employment report, which dropped today on Friday. And the change in non-farm payrolls was just from my point of view, it was pretty much a home run. And I mean, it crushed the bond market and you saw a massive rally in stock. Well, a strong rally in stocks. So I think that generally the market interpreted this report as being bullish. The change in non-farm payrolls came in at 353,000, which was 170,000 more than the estimate. And you also saw revisions. You saw 126,000 revised up in the last 2 months, which is, you know, pretty positive when you think about that. I mean, you're seeing a big headline. You're seeing a lot of revisions up. I mean, if you want to kind of like trash the report, you could say, okay, the response rate was a little low. The response rate wasn't as high as some of the previous reports. And so there's room for revisions in the future. And as we discussed last week, it's really the day of that the market discounts. And the revision, which is the more accurate number, market doesn't pay attention to. So, you know, that's one thing to keep in the back of your mind. But it really was a pretty strong report. If you want to like cast some shade and you're a bear, you could go look at the household survey, which is a broader measure of employment. And it includes agriculture and the self-employed. And that actually declined 31,000 in January. And the 3 month average there is minus 43,000 a month. So if you're a bear, that's what you're looking at. The thing about that though, is that includes like these very weather sensitive industries like agriculture. So I don't know if the January employment report that includes agriculture and the self-employed when the weather's loud to see is going to be as accurate, but that's what the bears are going to harp on. That all of this stuff left the unemployment rate in January at 3.7%, so unchanged. And the labor force participation rate was also left unchanged at 62.5%. And rounding it out, that leaves the underemployment rate at 7.2%, 10 basis points tick up from the previous. And there's a lot to unpack there, but I think just kind of without digging too much into the weeds, I interpret this as, and with all the other data we talked about this week that dropped, the labor market in the U.S. is still strong, and the U.S. economy is still remaining resilient in the face of these higher real interest rates that we're seeing. What do you think, Jeff?
I think you're right. I think that, you know, the response rate on the non-farm payroll being so low, certainly, the bears would point to that and say that that number is going to be revised lower. But with the 2 month previous revised higher by 126,000, you have a lot of wiggle room for that, the 353 to come down and still be kind of positive overall for the quarter. And I also think that this further shows why that ADP employment number is garbage and that everyone should ignore it, because it came in, you know, below expectations, 107,000. And then you got this great, you know, NFP number today that was higher than any of the Bloomberg, you know, Bloomberg does polls all these economists, and it was higher than the highest estimate. So, you know, once again, the economists have no idea what's going on with the labor market. They've underestimated the non-farm payroll number yet again. I think it's been like six out of the past 10 months they've underestimated it, and obviously a big miss here today.
Yeah, and that rounds us up for the macro data, but that kind of leads us to revisiting the Fed decision and the Fed presser, which was really important. And there were some very meaningful market-moving statements by the chair there.
Yeah, let's go right into the statement there. And I think the statement came in as expected. It really was stock market. You always use the stock market as your gauge on what's happened, what happens with the Fed. And from the statement, you know, Jay Powell kind of started off as he usually does and talks about the dual mandate and that the economy's made good progress. He did say inflation has eased from its highs without a significant increase in unemployment. That is very good news. But he also said, quote, but inflation is still too high. Ongoing progress to bringing it down is not assured, and the path forward is uncertain. So similar story as before, kind of being data dependent. Eric, as you said, they left their policy rate unchanged, and they did also leave their quantitative tightening, the reduction in their security holdings, also on the same pace. It was kind of notable, though, that when they talk about inflation in the statement, the statement said, quote, inflation has eased notably over the past year, but remains above our longer run goal of 2%. Total PCE prices rose 2.6% over the 12 months ending in December. And then they say that core PCE prices rose 2.9%. And kind of this is the story of the press conference was their quote that says the lower inflation readings over the second half of last year are welcome, but we will need to see continuing evidence to build confidence that inflation is moving down sustainably toward our goal. And so, you know, that was kind of it from the statement. Nothing really much going on. I guess they did drop that they've decreased their security holdings by $1.3 trillion. So that's a big number. And you really haven't seen too much collateral damage from that reduction in quantitative tightening. But we get to the press conference, and most of the questions, as you would expect, were kind of about the timing of the first cut or the first rate cut. When's it going to happen? What do they need to see based on the fact that they were talking about being a little bit more confident in that they have to be building confidence that inflation is moving sustainably towards our goal. And the first question was how do you get that confidence? And Powell said, quote, we do have confidence and it has been increasing. We want to get greater confidence. We're looking at continuation of the good data that we've been seeing. And a good example is inflation. So we have 6 months of good inflation data. The question really is that 6 months of good inflation data, is it sending us a true signal that we are, in fact, on a sustainable path down to 2% inflation? That's the question. And the answer will come from some more data that's also good data. Goods inflation running significantly negative. It's a reasonable assumption that over time, goods inflation will flatten out, probably approximately zero. That would mean the services sectors would have to contribute more. And that was end of quote there. So really, it's not a matter of seeing better data. It's just seeing a continuation of the good data. So everyone that was estimating that the Fed was going to cut rates because they have the 6 month annualized rate of core PCE was 1.9, so it's below the 2.2 level. That really said that they really want to see a longer term rate. And you know, one thing we've been talking about is that when they meet again on March 20th, they'll have two more CPI data points. So you kind of almost get like almost eight or nine months of data there. You can kind of take your 8 or 9 month annualized inflation rate. Is that, if that's below 2%, does that make them feel comfortable? Spoiler alert here, Jay Powell says later on, the answer to that question is no. We also, you know, they talk about the risks and the risk that inflation would reaccelerate. And he said, Jay Powell said, quote, "I think the greater risk is that it would inflation would stabilize at a level meaningfully above 2%. That's to me more likely. Of course, if inflation were to surprise by moving back up, we'd have to respond to that. And that would be a surprise at this point. But I have to tell you, that's why we keep our options open here and why we're not rushing," end quote there. So really, you know, he's trying to say we're going to be data dependent. If inflation comes in higher, we're going to have to cut. We're going to have to leave rates high at a higher level for longer. If they come in and they get their greater confidence, then they will determine to cut rates. Also said that, you know, they don't want I guess this is a good thing. They said that they don't want to wait for the economy to turn down before they cut rates, but that they do want to do it before that. And that, you know, this kind of talks about his base case here. And he said, in the base case, the economy is performing well. The labor market remains strong. We saw an unexpected weakening in the labor market that would weigh on cutting sooner. And if we saw inflation being stickier or higher or those sorts of things, we'd argue for moving later. In the base case, though, where the economy is healthy and we have, you know, we have ongoing growth, solid growth, we have a strong labor market, we have inflation coming down. So that's their base case, is kind of continuing the trend that we're seeing. And that kind of led right into the question that this was the big market moving event. You know, everything was going well. Stocks were up. People were feeling good about this press conference. And then there was a question, and the question was, I've heard from some district Fed presidents, is it in your view a little premature to think that rate cuts are right around the corner? And Powell's answer, you know, it is a long answer, but we'll kind of cut to the chase here. He said, we're going to be data dependent. We're going to be looking at this meeting by meeting. Based on the meeting today, I would tell you that I don't think it's likely that the committee will reach a level of confidence by the time of the March meeting to identify March as the time to do that. But that's to be seen. So I wouldn't call, you know, when you would ask me about in the near term, I'm hearing that as March. I would say that's probably not the most likely case, or what we would call the base case. And really, the markets did not like that. Stock market sold off very dramatically. We did see that the WIRP kind of shifted here. So we're down to a 23% or 22% today odds of a Fed rate cut in March. May is actually looks like 69% probability of a rate cut in May. 22% in March, 69% in May. And we're actually down to just under 5 cuts throughout this year. So that was the statement that the markets didn't like. That kind of, it's actually kind of boxed the Fed into a corner, right? So what happens if inflation comes in well below expectations here, and they're like, we're still not talking about March as the base case. And so it kind of shifted market expectations, and we kind of saw it in terms of interest rates there. You know, they kind of tried to also, the questions tried to kind of pin him down on, like, one of the questions was, do you feel comfortable saying the economy has reached a soft landing, or is that part of looking for more confidence? And, you know, they try to trick him. What is he supposed to, you know, we're always like, we hear the question and we're on the desk and we're like, don't jinx it. And so Powell's answer was, no, I wouldn't say we've achieved that. And I think we have a ways to go. Inflation is, core inflation is still well above target on a 12-month basis. 12 months is our target, certainly. I'm encouraged, and we're encouraged by the progress, but we're not declaring victory at all at this point. We think we have a ways to go. So he wasn't going to fall, you know, Jay Powell wasn't going to fall into that trap about declaring a victory and a soft landing there. And then finally, we got to this thing that I was expecting to be a little bit more of the crux of the question. So that was the quantity, because we were certainly expecting no rate cut on Wednesday. So I thought the focus was going to be a lot more on the quantitative tightening side. We finally did get a question on quantitative tightening, and the question asked if they were, you know, did they discuss the possibility of slowing balance sheet runoff? And Powell's answer was, balance sheet runoff so far has gone very well, and as the process has continued, we're getting to that time where questions are beginning to come into greater focus about the pace of runoff. So at this meeting, we did have some discussion of the balance sheet, and we're planning to begin in-depth discussions of balance sheet issues at our next meeting in March. So if you think about that, they'll discuss the balance sheet in March. Certainly because he said that, there's going to be some questions about QT at the March press conference. And, you know, maybe they do another thing where they're going to start, you know, they're starting to talk about it, starting to think about it. Maybe we see another June type quantitative tightening tapering of the quantitative tightening. Just, you know, they started it. They announced it, I think, in March. The quantitative tightening, they announced the start of that in March, to happen in June. So I think that would give a little bit of symmetry there this time around also. And then one of the things, one of the other questions that we've been seeing a lot is do they need the reverse repo facility, because that's providing some liquidity. It's kind of counterbalancing that quantitative tightening. And that reverse repo balances have been coming down very quickly. Do they need to get to zero, or can we start with, there's a couple $100 billion, give or take, in the reverse repo facility? Is that a basis enough for them to start tapering the QT? And Jay Powell did say, I wouldn't think we'd be taking a position that it's got to go to zero. If it were to stabilize at a different level, and he kind of stopped his train of thought there. He said, but that's not a decision we've made. So certainly they would feel comfortable with reverse repo level being at, you know, stabilizing at a level. If it's a couple $100 billion, they would probably be fine with that, and then start the tapering the quantitative tightening. There was a couple more interesting kind of off-topic statements that Powell did make. One we were joking about on the trading desk was, they were talking about this discussion on the Fed and the Fed committee, and Jay Powell said, we do have a healthy set of differences, and I think that's actually essential for making good policy. We're also able to reach agreement generally because we listen to each other, we compromise, and even though not everybody loves what we do, they're able to, for the most part, able to join in. To me, that's a well-functioning public institution. And on the desk, we were like, oh, that's a jab at Congress right there. Being able to have a conversation, join in, compromise. That's a well-functioning public institution there, is the Fed. And then lastly, they were talking about the Taylor rule. And Jay Powell did say, we consult them regularly. They're in our teal book, and they're in all the materials that we look at. And we kind of looked at each other like, what's this teal book? We know the beige book. We get that information, but what's the teal book? So I did a little bit of research there. And
super secret book.
Yeah, it is a super secret book. It started with the green book in 1964. Which is that just kind of the current economic conditions of the U.S. and the international economy. Then in 1965, they had the Blue Book, which was titled the Monetary Policy Alternatives. And that's a super secret one that not even everyone on the you know, at the Fed gets. Only certain super secret people get the Blue Book. And so, of course, when they decided, you know, it was different staff produced the Blue Book and the Green Book. So they decided, let's be a little bit more efficient. Let's create the one book, the teal book, as you could expect, the blue and the green combined to create teal. But they actually get the teal book, and it's in part A and part B. So some people still don't get that part B that used to be the blue book. But they do have that efficiency, or they reduce that redundancy of different staff producing two different books. And also it kind of improved the flow between the current economic environment and then the monetary policy alternatives. So those of you that were wondering, that is what the teal book is.
We need to see a Trading Places 2 about the teal book, and, you know, the story revolves around that. That'd be pretty funny.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll get Beaks out there to get the blue book for us.
And I think that was pretty comprehensive. I mean, that was the meeting, and I think you nailed it. Just a lot of stuff, but disappointed the market's desire for cuts.
Yeah. Well, Eric, it looks like it's a light week next week on the macro front. I guess it was front-end loaded on this past week. So why don't you just show people what things to keep an eye on for next week?
Yeah, fortunately for you part-time economists and macro traders, you don't have much this coming week. We'll see what happens. We get ISM services for January on Monday. And we also get the SLOOS. If you're a Fed watcher, we get the SLOOS report, the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey on Bank Lending Practices. That's a useful piece, but dense. It'll give color on the banking system. If you're concerned, that's definitely something to look at in light of some of the banking troubles we've seen in the market this week. Consumer credit drops on Wednesday. That'll be the December number. Thursday, we get initial jobless claims and continuing claims, and those are kind of forecasted to be very similar to their previous prints. And we get wholesale trade data and wholesale inventories on Thursday as well. So very light week. Kind of maybe take some time to dive into the SLOOS report. Check it out.
All right. And also things to keep an eye out for next week. We have Morris Chen on Bloomberg TV on Monday at, I think, 9:20 Pacific time, they're talking ETFs. Also, we should expect that Ken Shinoda's most recent Channel 11 should be coming on Tuesday. The title there is No Free Money on Wall Street. But that's about it for things to keep an eye on for next week. So I'd like to thank everyone for listening.
Yeah, thanks to our listeners out there on DL Minutes. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can catch the latest episode on your favorite podcast platform. Hit us up on Twitter at DLine Minutes and send us your questions, or send us an email at minutes@doubleline.com.
Yeah, please send us questions. I know we have one from a listener we'll get to next week, but after that, it's open season, so please let us know. Don't forget our website is doubleline.com. YouTube channel is youtube.com/doubleline capital. We have some bonus footage of the Roundtable Prime from earlier in January. We also have Jeffrey Gundlach's Spaces interview that he did last week. Ken Shinoda's FOMC appearance on Bloomberg TV, which I couldn't catch live, so I was happy that was up there already. So to see what Ken said there, and make sure that you follow the other podcast on our podcast platform at Sherman Show Pod. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and I hope everyone has a great weekend.
This presentation was recorded on the date indicated. Views and opinions expressed herein are those of the individual and do not necessarily reflect the views of DoubleLine Capital LP, its affiliates, or employees, should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities, and are subject to change without notice. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. The presentation represents DoubleLine's intellectual property. No portion of this presentation may be published, reproduced, transmitted, or rebroadcast in any media, in any form, without the express written permission of DoubleLine. DoubleLine has no obligation to provide any updates or changes. To receive permission from DoubleLine, please contact media@doubleline.com. Neither DoubleLine nor any of its affiliates makes any representations or warranties regarding the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this material. Liability, including any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage, is explicitly disclaimed. DoubleLine is not providing any financial, economic, legal, accounting, or tax advice. The receipt of this presentation by any listener should not be construed as the provision of investment advice by any DoubleLine entity or individual, nor does it imply that such person becomes a client of any DoubleLine entity. The portfolio risk management process includes an effort to monitor and manage risk, but it does not imply low risk. Copyright 2023, DoubleLine Capital.